This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
When the Fed and the Treasury went to Congress last fall, it was all about those toxic assets, the mortgage-backed securities. We had to purge them from the banking system. But after Congress wrote the $700 billion check, the plan changed. It was all about capitalizing banks and unlocking consumer credit. Well, guess what? We're back to the toxic assets. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at CargillCreates.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Scott Jagow in for Kai Rizdahl. Glad you can join me on this Tuesday, January 13th. Today, Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke gave a speech at the London School of Economics. He said Obama's stimulus plan will give a significant boost to the economy, but it won't be enough. Bernanke wants the government to give banks, brace yourself, more money and to help homeowners in trouble. Bernanke also brought us back to the toxic assets burning a hole in bank balance sheets. For that problem, he thinks we should create bad banks. You'd think we've had enough of those, but as Ashley Milntide explains, here's what Bernanke means.
When the government started pumping money into banks back in October, it left it up to the institutions to save themselves. By creating bad banks, the government will be taking matters into its own hands. Eric Benrood teaches finance at Drexel University.
Well, in this case, they would actually be creating entities that would be distinct from the original banks, and they would just simply be buying assets that they would put into a portfolio and presumably try to manage.
Financial firms could sell their dodgy securities to the government's bad banks. They'd be paid with a combination of shares in the bad banks and cash. And there's the risk for you and I. At least some of that cash would be taxpayer money. Dennis Logue is an emeritus professor at Dartmouth's Tuck School of Business. He says some of the assets, like rotten credit card loans, aren't ever going to make money. But if all goes well, others will appreciate in value and could turn a profit for the government. Either way, he says, creating bad banks will ultimately help ordinary Americans.
Meanwhile, you leave the regular bank intact, and the role of the senior managers in the good bank is to go out and make loans and figure out which companies they deal with can be helped, which consumers they deal with that can be helped.
He says the government's bad banks could turn out to be not so bad after all. They could let financial institutions get back to their regular jobs and get the economy's wheels turning again. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Bernanke's plan calls for the government to set up these bad banks, but the Financial Times says Citigroup is planning to create its own bad bank where it can store its toxic investments. If the government's even going to consider giving banks more money, it'd be a good idea to figure out what's going on with the money they've already gotten. $189 billion went to more than 250 banks. Let's hear about tracking that money from Marketplace's Steve Henn.
When the U.S. Treasury started making big investments in banks, it had a simple goal: to increase lending. This is Neel Kashkari, the Assistant Secretary of the Treasury last fall, explaining why so much money was going to supposedly healthy banks.
The answer is, if we have a dollar and we give this dollar to a healthy bank, that healthy bank is much more likely to turn around and extend credit with that same dollar.
But after getting almost $200 billion in taxpayers' money, many banks still aren't lending. And today, Kashkari tried to explain why.
As long as confidence remains low, banks will remain cautious about extending credit, and consumers and businesses will remain cautious about taking on new loans.
In a speech today, Kashkari said the Treasury Department will begin comparing lending levels at banks that got government money with similar banks that didn't. But Vincent Reinhardt, a former Fed economist, now at the American Enterprise Institute, says measuring the effect of government money on a bank's lending is almost impossible.
The management of the bank knows a lot more about the bank than you do. And once you give them the capital, it's very hard to know what they did with it.
Kashkari says the Treasury Department will rely on quarterly reports regulators already require. But Reinhardt says those reports are notoriously unreliable. So if you're asking yourself whether the American public is getting what it paid for in the banking bailout, Reinhardt says you may as well just take a step back, look at the economy, and decide for yourself. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
As Steve said, the whole idea of capitalizing banks was to get them to lend. And there are finally some signs the credit markets are loosening. We're joined now by Peter Cohen, a financial analyst with Peter Cohen and Associates. Welcome to the program, Peter.
Oh, it's great to be here.
So we're seeing interbank lending rates slowly but surely come down. How much of this can we attribute to the TARP money, to the money we gave the banks?
I would say we can attribute zero of that to the TARP money. And here's the reason why. The TARP money went to buy equity stakes, relatively small equity stakes in banks for the most part, with a little bit going to Chrysler and GM. And the fact of the matter is we don't know what the banks are actually doing with that. Are they spending it on bonuses? Are they spending it to pay people? We don't know. But the fact of the matter is that what's really moved the TED spread has been something that the Fed actually did. They spent $2.4 trillion to buy commercial paper, and that's a huge injection of money into the commercial paper market. And because of that, people are a lot more confident about doing those kinds of short-term loans.
I don't want to get too into the weeds for my own personal safety, but explain the TED spread in a couple of sentences.
Well, it's basically a difference between how much the banks lend to each other over a three-month period. It's also known as LIBOR. That's one of the parts of the equation. And the other part is the three-month Treasury bill rate. So when you subtract the LIBOR from the Treasury bill rate, that's the TED spread. And it was 486 basis points, which is 4.86%. And now it's down below 100 basis points, or 1%. So the spread getting narrower means that there's much less risk and there's a lot more liquidity in the short-term credit markets.
So it has to do with the perceived, at least, credit risk in the economy.
Yes. If the rate is very, very high over a three-month period, that means that banks are terrified to lend to each other. But when it gets below 100 basis points, that's good. I mean, it should be about 30 basis points, but it's made a huge, huge progress.
Now, let's get back to the TARP money. If the idea was to get banks lending again, and we're not seeing any direct correlation between the TARP money and what is happening here, why did we give the banks so much money?
Well, we gave them the money because Hank Paulson said, we need this money or heaven help us. I think one of the things that I think is good is that in trying to get that second $350 billion that the Congress and the President are going to try to get a more of an accounting of what they're doing with it, and then we'll have a better idea of whether it's helping or not.
Now, it's fine to hear that the TED spread is lower and that the LIBOR rate is down, but how are we going to know on the ground that we're actually seeing the credit markets loosen up?
Well, the key thing is that 70% of GDP growth is attributable to consumer spending. And one of the reasons why the unemployment rate is going up, the GDP is shrinking, is because consumers can't borrow to buy things like houses and cars.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because the banks and the people who might extend that credit are just really nervous about getting repaid. So we're going to know things are improving when people start buying cars. You'll see those monthly car statistics actually go up. So that's really going to be the test.
So all we have to do is look out for the neighbor's new car?
Absolutely. Absolutely. If you start seeing people driving shiny new cars instead of rusty old ones, you'll know that things are getting better.
I think that's still a ways off, Peter.
I'm afraid it's several years off.
All right. Peter Cohen runs his own venture capital firm. His new book is called You Can't Order Change, Lessons from Jim McNerney's Turnaround at Boeing. Thanks for joining us, Peter.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Wall Street loves the idea of mopping up toxic assets, but overall, company books still don't look so good. More on that when we do the numbers. Today, Hillary Clinton laid out her vision for U.S. foreign policy. She was testifying at Senate confirmation hearings. She's Barack Obama's pick for Secretary of State. Not all of Obama's nominees are from his own party. He's reaching across the aisle, and that seems like a good strategy for cutting through bipartisanship. But it can also be risky, as history points out. Here's commentator Dan Dresner.
There is a crisis of leadership in the United States. Politically, we're in a transition period where George W. Bush is still the president, but has no real authority. Beyond the Beltway, America has also lost confidence in our economic and financial leaders. The reputations of Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson and Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke have taken a big hit. Financial titans like Alan Greenspan and Robert Rubin have been discredited. Even Warren Buffett's faith in the stock market looks wrong-headed. It is therefore not surprising that Americans are looking to President-elect Barack Obama to provide leadership. In response, Obama consciously embraces a team of rivals approach to management. This catchphrase is the title of Doris Kearns Goodwin's book about Abraham Lincoln's cabinet. Goodwin argues that these experienced, ambitious men all thought themselves deserving of the presidency. And yet, through Lincoln's leadership, they managed to win the Civil War and preserve the Union. But other leaders were not as successful. Millard Fillmore appointed his rivals, and his presidency was not covered in glory. George W. Bush's first cabinet was also a group of experienced, ambitious organization men, and look how that turned out. A cabinet of bickering egotists is just as likely to implode as excel. The key factor that will determine whether this team of rivals works well together is Barack Obama's leadership style. George W. Bush put together a group of strong-willed individuals, but displayed little interest in refereeing disputes among them. Will Obama do better? Obama's preternatural calm provides one clue. With markets and politicians in a state of panic, Obama has demonstrated that he appreciates the gravity of the situation, but will not be overwhelmed by it. Even more encouraging is Obama's ability to understand and explain contending points of view. If Obama can show his cabinet that he has truly heard their views, they will be more willing to support him, even if he goes in another direction. By encouraging debate without alienating his team of egos, Barack Obama might just plug the leadership gap.
Dan Dresner is a professor of international politics at Tufts University. His most recent book is called All Politics is Global. Share your opinions with us at marketplace.org. I'm afraid there's still no good news about the housing market. New home building is especially not happening. Housing starts are down 70% from 2 years ago. And the fallout of that can be seen at any lumber yard in this country. Stacks and stacks of wood. Lumber prices are at their lowest in 18 years. And so, in small towns all over the Northwest, plants are closing and people are losing their jobs. We're joined now by Andrew Miller, the CEO of Stimson Lumber in Portland, Oregon. Stimson also has plants in Idaho, Washington, and Montana. Welcome to the program, Andrew.
Hello, thanks.
I'm afraid to ask, but how's business?
It's very poor. I mean, I could use some, more colorful language.
But, well, not on the radio.
But, it's very depressed. We've closed 5 facilities in the past 18 months, all in reaction to declining economics as a result of reduced demand, reduced pricing, just really preparing for what we believe was going to be a long and deep recession.
How many jobs is that?
A specific mill has probably been 80 or 90. I think as a company, we're probably down about 900 jobs from 3 years ago.
Is this all about the housing market?
For the most part, we've had a couple mills that maybe their long-term viability was in question, but the immediate decision to close the mills was based on poor economics.
And when you close these plants, what is the trickle-down effect beyond just the closures?
They're pretty significant because our facilities operate in small rural communities where we're often the major or a major employer, so just due to geographic isolation, there are not many comparable job opportunities. And so beyond economics, I think it just puts a lot of stress in these small communities. If the mill doesn't start up again, it's unlikely that there's going to be another major industrial employer that would locate in that town.
So are you expecting to see a new wave of ghost towns in the upper Northwest?
No, more so than probably already exist. I just think there are probably some communities that this just kind of exasperates, you know, an already difficult economic situation.
Andrew, besides closing plants, what else is your company doing to make it through the recession?
Every day, you got to just be on your toes. I mean, I think for the first time in a long time, people are going to get paid for the quality of their management, their decisiveness, business plan. I think for 10, 15 plus years, we've been living in an environment where the tide was coming in and you just put your boat in the water, showed up, turned the power on, and you generally made money. You know, everyone was doing okay. And I think now the difference is going to be if people that really know their business and also are willing to make some tough decisions about preserving capital, they're going to be the survivors and the people that prosper. The folks that were just sort of in the water because the tide was coming in, they're being swept out to sea.
Andrew Miller, the CEO of Stimson Lumber Company, thanks for joining us and best of luck.
Thank you.
Coming up on the program, Macau just became a gambling empire, and just as quickly, its pockets are emptying.
When you look at that spectacular success, then every other person and his dog, you know, wanted to get in on the action.
But first, let's do the numbers. Gloomy corporate profit reports seem to be Wall Street's albatross right now. Today, the Dow fell for a fifth straight day, down 25 points, just a fraction, to close at 8,448. The NASDAQ rose 7 points, half a percent, to 1,546. The S&P 500 added just 1 point to wrap up at 871. Case in point about the profit reports, GE fell 5.5% after an analyst adjusted GE's earnings estimate. Oil prices rose, and so did energy shares. ExxonMobil added almost 2%. Chevron and ConocoPhillips were both up more than a percent. Stocks in Europe and Asia all ended lower. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose over 2%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com. Want more from Marketplace's special Fallout coverage? It's all on our website. You'll find special podcasts, videos, and the Marketplace Decoder, a simple guide to financial terms and products. Go to marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on retail sales for December. The Federal Reserve Board releases its Beige Book survey of current economic conditions. And a House committee takes a look at the state of small businesses and ways to spur an economic recovery. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Scott Jagow in for Kai Rizdahl. Today, New York's Attorney General Andrew Cuomo announced a big settlement with health insurance companies. United Health Group has agreed to spend $50 million to create a new database. It'll help determine patient reimbursement rates. Cuomo had accused United Health Group of manipulating the numbers and overcharging millions of people. And this settlement could affect other major insurers. Here's Sarah Gardner.
Millions of insured Americans go out of network to get what they think is the best care. United Health said it used an independent database to determine reimbursements. But after patients complained of stingy payouts, Cuomo's office started investigating. Turns out, United Health owns the company that operates that database. It's called Ingenix. Nancy Nielsen, president of the American Medical Association, says insurers typically promise to pay a hefty percentage of out-of-network costs.
So then they go out of network expecting that the bill is going to be 80% paid by the insurer. And what they find out is, oh no, it's not the bill, it's what we think the bill ought to be. That's the dilemma.
Under the settlement, Ingenix will close, and United Health will fund a new independent database run by a nonprofit, Andrew Cuomo.
A company that's not owned by the insurance industry, not controlled by the insurance industry, not manipulated by the insurance industry, not part of a virtual monopoly of the insurance industry, but a fair company.
United Health denied it manipulated reimbursement data. Today, an insurance trade group said this controversy sheds light on one reason for rising medical costs: wide disparities in what out-of-network doctors charge. This settlement has national implications, since many other health insurers use Ingenix too. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
It's tough sledding out there if you're a charity or a foundation or a university endowment. But the money hasn't completely dried up. This week, Stanford snagged $100 million from some wealthy alums. The money will help create a new research center for global warming. Schools may have to rely on private funding for a while, but that could cause some sticky situations. Marketplace's Janet Babin reports from our innovations desk at North Carolina Public Radio.
Stanford's new Precourt Institute for Energy will create renewable energy and global warming solutions. The institute got most of its money from two big donors, $50 million from Stanford alum Jay Precourt and $40 million from Stanford trustee Tom Steyer and his wife Kat Taylor. The institute's director, Lynn Orr, says the money arrives at a time when government grants have dropped off and the university's cutting costs.
Our endowments have been hit just like everybody else's.
While the private sector money is desperately needed, it can raise questions. Both major donors have ties to industry. Precourt's an energy executive, and Steyer's a partner at a firm that invests on behalf of universities. But Orr says the companies will get no special deals from the institute's work.
These are gifts to the university, and we will make the decisions inside the university about how the work is done and what research gets funded.
UC Berkeley ran into controversy when it started a similar energy institute backed by BP. And today, Chevron announced it would endow a $2.5 million energy chair at UC Davis. For cash-strapped universities, it appears the private sector is the only option left.
The ivory tower is gone.
Dan Greenberg wrote the book Science for Sale.
The record seems to show that universities are much more interested in getting the money and getting on with the project than they are in protecting their traditional values.
Like truth-seeking over profits. President-elect Obama says he'll double funding for basic research, but that may not be nearly enough for innovation's expensive tastes. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
It's already become a cliche that no industry is immune from this recession. I vow never to say that. But I will point you in the direction of Macau, China. It's the world's gambling capital. Yes, even bigger than Vegas. Macau seemingly came out of nowhere to rise up into a casino giant. But the economy has just as quickly knocked it down a notch. Or 10. Reporting from Macau, here's Marketplace's Scott Tong.
Macau is a tiny peninsula plus two little islands right next to Hong Kong. It became part of China 9 years ago, and for 400 years before that, it was a part of Portugal. But today, the language of the moment is Italian. This is Macau's Venetian resort, land of indoor canals, singing gondola operators, and the biggest casino on the planet. Hundreds of Chinese tourists pull the slots and wager at baccarat. But foot traffic here has plunged the last 3 months. Just outside this building, two massive construction sites sit idle.
Basically, the bubble has burst.
John App is a tourism industry analyst.
It's always about build it and hope that they will come, and then when they don't come, then you get the spectacular collapses.
Macau's boom began 7 years ago. U.S. casino operator Las Vegas Sands received the first foreign gaming permit here. It spent $250 million on its first resort, and it made its money back in just a year. thanks to a flood of Chinese gamblers.
When you look at that spectacular success, then every other person and his dog, you know, wanted to get in on the action.
Competitors followed, like MGM Mirage and Wynn Resorts. The industry giants supersized the economy. And by 2007, Macau's gaming revenue topped Las Vegas and Atlantic City combined.
I mean, you see this humongous sort of development. We have the Venetian.
Sanjay Nadkarni teaches tourism at Macau University of Science and Technology, right by Casino Row. He says to understand Macau, pay no attention to the tourists at the Venetian. They don't matter.
Many of them may just be gawking. And even if they were to go to the casinos, they're not exactly the big fish.
The big fish. High rollers put in 80% of all casino revenue. These VIPs are Chinese tycoons, and in some cases, corrupt government officials playing with the public money.
I mean, these people, we don't see them. It's all in whispers. We don't talk about that. Don't ask, don't tell.
The big fish even have their own loan sharks to ratchet up the betting. That provided the leverage for the casino industry on the way up, until luck ran out. Last summer, China put limits on mainlanders' trips to Macau, in part to curb corruption. And then the markets collapsed. Las Vegas Sands, in particular, got pounded. Its stock fell 93% last year. And by November, the company laid off 11,000 construction workers. A few hundred guys in hard hats still trudge around, but jobs are scarce here. This woman runs a construction site food truck.
Business is bad. The companies are failing. So my food business is down by half. How long can I stay afloat? I don't know.
The Chinese government is watching closely how hard Macau falls. This resort and casino town is a high-profile jewel, and many assume Beijing will bail it out if it has to. So don't bet against the house just yet. In Macau, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, even the guy nominated for Treasury Chief can't figure out his taxes. Timothy Geithner, he's Obama's choice to succeed Hank Paulson. He told senators today he didn't pay $34,000 in taxes from 2001 to 2004. During that period, he worked for the International Monetary Fund, and he was technically considered self-employed. He was supposed to pay Medicare and Social Security taxes. The IRS notified him of the problem in 2006, and he has paid most of the tab. Today, Obama did reiterate his support for Geithner. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 25 points, a third of a percent. The NASDAQ rose 7, half a percent. And the S&P 500 added 1 point, just a hair. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Renita Jablonski on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. Next time on the program, computer programs come in Spanish and English, of course.
But there are lots and lots of other languages out there that have much smaller populations or may not be as commercially accessible, but still do serve large communities.
Like Zulu. I'm Scott Jagow. Hope you can join us again tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.